Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. 2013 has been the year of Kim. Rarely a week has gone by when the North Korean despot Kim Jong-un has been off our front pages, either terrorizing his own people or threatening to take over the world. We speak to a former ambassador to the Hermit Kingdom to ask him what North Korea is really like on the inside and why it matters so much to the rest of us. I'm joined in the studio by Rob Colville, The Telegraph's head of comment, and by John Everard, a former UK ambassador to North Korea. We had intended this podcast to be one of those generic roundup of the year style programs. But when we got down to thinking about all the stories of 2013, one stood head and shoulders above all the rest. North Korea. Despite being 30 years out of date, grindingly poor and creepily authoritarian, North Korea continues to dominate world diplomacy and the West's imagination. Why has Kim Jong-un enjoyed so much press attention in 2013, from shooting his uncle to prescribing revolutionary hairdos to his own downtrodden people? We are fortunate to be joined by a man who understands North Korea from the inside out, the former UK ambassador to North Korea, John Everard, whose book, Only Beautiful Please, A British Diplomat in North Korea, documents life in the communist madhouse. John, could we start by asking, why has 2013 felt like the year of Kim?
I think there are a few reasons. Firstly, we are now looking at North Korea ruled by Kim Jong-un, who is a very different person from his father, Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il was something of a recluse, very, very rarely spoke in public, very rarely seen in public, clearly uncomfortable in front of cameras, and usually surrounded by a very small coterie of people. Kim Jong-un actually gets out and about a lot more, shakes hands, smiles at cameras, and of course we've got to see his rather attractive young wife, who was just given birth. So there's a different personal star at the top. That's one reason. Secondly, remember that the first half of 2013 was pretty grim. We had North Korea hurling blood-curdling threats at all its neighbours, at the United States. You remember the photograph of the missile trajectories from North Korea to various American cities?
Yes.
It didn't actually start as a cuddly little world. But then, as of April, the North Korean regime switched to a charm offensive. And all of a sudden, for several months, we found the North Koreans going around and talking to the world. And things started to happen that have never happened before. Here in the UK, the North Korean ambassador actually went and gave a lecture at Cambridge University just a few weeks ago. We found North Koreans smiling and drinking coffee at the United Nations with other delegations. Signs that North Koreans were starting to act more like normal people, if you like. I would love to think that this happy state of affairs would continue, but I have my doubts. Firstly, it's clear that to the North Koreans that the charm offensive has failed. They wanted to secure, through being nice to people, all kinds of goodies, aid, political support, recognition as a nuclear state, and they've got none of that. And now, of course, we have the execution of Jang Song-taek, one of the, I was going to say most outward-looking, probably better to say least inward-looking, of the senior North Koreans.
Why has that shocked people in the West so much? Because North Koreans get shot on a daily basis. Anyone who's familiar with the state's politics knows that this is a natural part of statecraft. So why do you think this execution has really gripped people's attention?
You're right. North Korea conducts a lot of shootings, but not of the members of the imperial family.
Right.
It has shocked the world. It has shocked, I think, most North Koreans, partly because he was so senior. And traditionally in North Korea, people that senior don't get shot. You get sort of sent off to a labor camp if you're unlucky, or to manage an obscure unit into the countryside if you're relatively lucky, which is what happened to him first time round. Remember, this isn't the first time that he's been purged.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, he is an older man and an uncle to Kim Jong-un. Now, leaving aside the socialist aspect of North Korea's polity, it is a deeply conservative Confucian state. You simply do not shoot old men. You show them respect. And this also will have jarred in North Korea. But I think in China, and in particular, what will have shocked people most of all isn't so much the disappearance of Jang Song-taek, the man, as the disappearance of what he represented. Mm-hmm. He was the man who did deals with China. He was in charge of at least some, possibly all, of the special economic zones that North Korea is trying to establish, which are aimed principally at attracting Chinese capital. He was deeply engaged in trade with China. And we saw in the two extraordinary reports, which act as the indictment against Jang Song-taek, that selling North Korean minerals to China at the price it agreed was a crime that he was sending North Korea out. And also that what he might have thought was a fairly straightforward commercial act, signing off a 5-year lease on parts of the Rason special economic zone to China, that also is a crime.
Right. So very quickly, does that then represent a slight U-turn on their embrace of trade with China and with the outside world?
Or yes, it does. I mean, they have been protesting the contrary. The regime just a couple of days ago said that its goals remained unchanged. But if you are a Chinese trader, especially if you are a Chinese investor, you want some kind of stability and some kind of protection against North Korean corruption and rapacity. It'd be too much to expect the full protection of rule of law in North Korea, but you want something. In a world where trade deals are being ripped up and 5-year leases are being declared illegitimate, where do you go?
Yeah.
It's very hard to see Chinese investors now wanting to continue to put money into North Korea. And people tell me that the Rason zone is actually very quiet right now.
Okay. Rob Colville, if I can bring you in at this point. I have a very confused impression of what's going on in North Korea. On the one hand, you see stuff which suggests total control. On the other hand, you could interpret these sorts of events as panicking and chaotic. Which do you think it is? Is this a state in chaos or is this a state in control?
Well, the problem with North Korea, the big question with North Korea is that we just don't know.
Right.
I mean, the people of North Korea have put up with, you know, far worse than this. When they had the drought and starvation,
the artist march.
They have suffered beyond anything we can imagine.
This is the famine in the mid 90s.
Exactly, and you know, and through the many decades before that. So this is, I suppose, the key question, especially once we look forward, is to what extent the people still buy into it.
Right.
To what extent, you know, links with China, trade links, internet, mobile phones, all the things, sort of, all the sort of cracks in the wall. Do they accept that they are ruled by madmen and they just have to sit there and make the best of it? Or the scarier version, do they actually buy into this? Do they buy into all the weird racial stuff? Do they buy into the ideology of the Kim family? And that has profound implications because it means that even when the regime collapses,
what is the racial stuff and what is the ideology?
Well, I mean, the ideology is this sort of lunatic veneration of the Kim family to the point of, I mean, all the stories they tell about, you know, they were born on the holy mountain under the seven-pointed star of, you know, angels appeared blowing trumpets and all the rest of it.
Mountains danced.
Mountains actually danced. You know, they go off and play a round of golf and miraculously get more holes in one in the first time he picks up a club, then dashes off an opera before going out for another 9 holes.
But you mentioned racial stuff as well.
Yes. There was a really interesting book recently. I mean, the North Koreans, I mean, this is why the visit of Dennis Rodman would have been a sort of bizarre spectacle to many in North Korea, because at the heart of the North Korean ideology is a very, very poisonous racial component, not just to do with the superiority of Korea, but to do with the superiority of North Koreans. These poor people have been brought up to believe that they are not just living in a wonderland, but they are the chosen race.
My golly, what must they think other people are like if that's the best of a bad bunch? John.
Yeah, perhaps I could pick up on a few of those
points.
Please do. The racial stuff, absolutely. I'm so glad you raised this. It is a common mistake amongst commentators to describe North Korea as a Stalinist state. It isn't. If you are looking for Western analogues, by some margin, the closest one is Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. North Korea is a state that believes quite clearly in racial superiority, in the superiority of Koreans over other people because they are Korean.
Right.
And it's... it also believes strongly in racial purity. Uncomfortable comparisons with Nazi Germany. So you need to remember that where North Korean women who go to China end up pregnant by Chinese men, that the baby is always killed on birth.
So really?
Always killed on birth, so as to prevent North Korean blood being polluted. And there was an extraordinary incident, just by way of anecdotal illustration, during one of the North-South talks last year, I think, where one of the North Koreans said to the Southerners, we understand that in some places your farmers can't find good Korean girls so that they import Vietnamese. Yes, said the South Koreans, this is quite common. This is monstrous. This is pollution of the pure river of the North Korean nation, of the Korean nation, they said. And we're quite hot under the collar of this. You know, Koreans should not marry foreigners. It's wrong, wrong, wrong.
So is there any Marxist element to this ideology anymore at all?
Less and less. Right. If you dig deep, you can find Marxist elements. But Marxism-Leninism has now been written out of the North Korean constitution.
Right.
I mean, legally, it's no longer a Marxist-Leninist state. And the portraits of Marx and Engels that used to adorn Kim Il-sung Square went, I think, last year sometime.
So instead, it's veneration of the army, of the family?
Not so much of the army. It is veneration of the single great leader, of the demigod Kim.
Right.
In this historical perspective, North Korea picks up large elements of what 19th century Korea used to be like. It's important to remember that before the Japanese annexation, that Korea was a very strange place, mm-hmm. Much more like Tibet or Bhutan than anything in the modern world, and up until, I think it was 1870, the law was that any foreigner found on Korean soil should be killed on sight, again, so as not to pollute the nation. The king was an infallible demigod, and no Korean would ever speak ill of the king. So that in comes Kim Il-sung, taking over at the foundation of North Korea, and he simply picks up these political traditions and carries them forward into a world which, of course, in the meantime, has changed beyond recognition,
yeah.
And where they grate and they jar to a far greater extent than they did 150 years ago.
And especially with now Kim Jong-un, what we're witnessing, in a way, is a bizarre fusion of this ancient tradition and the sort of Western celebrity culture.
Right. You know,
because even if his people don't have access to the latest Western media, he certainly does. One of the Kim family was arrested trying to sneak into Disneyland in Japan. They're clearly as besotted as anyone with the people they see on their TV screens. So you've got this.
Absolutely.
They're trying to set up North Korean pop groups. They're trying to they're trying to create this sort of bizarre hybrid of sort of feudal monarchy and glitzy showbiz lifestyle.
Absolutely. We analysts first, I think, were confirmed in our expectations that things had changed when Mickey Mouse appeared in one of the North Korean mass games shortly after Kim Jong-un came to power. And access to the media. Remember that Kim Jong-il had one of the most extensive collections of Western movies anywhere in the world. He's got an entire building full of them. Or he had.
Including pornography, isn't he? A vast
quite
collection.
Possibly so.
Yes. When Mickey Mouse shows up, do you think the average North Korean will know that's Disney? What are they thinking when they see that?
Mickey Mouse has penetrated even North Korea and is
right.
recognisable as a kind of icon. You occasionally see, even 5 years ago when I was there, you saw North Korean kids with Mickey Mouse T-shirts.
Okay.
Identifiable as a
foreigner. One of my favourite moments in Southeast Asia is entering Laos, which is a nominally communist country. And this was sort of 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and as you came across the border, there was a giant sign saying, Pepsi welcomes you to the People's Democratic Republic.
Yes. So it seems to me, then, pulling all this together, that really it's somewhat misleading to think of North Korea as a communist Stalinist hangover from the Cold War, that really its story is one of continuity from the 19th century rather than communism representing a break from what happened before.
I think that's right.
So we're looking really at almost feudal society rather than a super modern one, because I just think that quite often
feudalism never happened in Korea, or for that matter anywhere in East Asia.
Right.
The entire social setup was radically different. I won't go into that now. But it is, yes, this is a very traditional, conservative Asian society that has, through an extraordinary series of circumstances, survived almost unchanged mm-hmm. into the 21st century.
Okay.
And that's the key question, because, when East and West Germany combined, granted there were huge disparities of wealth between the two, but the East Germans didn't buy into, most of them didn't buy into the ideology. The TV broadcasts had come across from the West. They knew what they were getting into. Whereas even when North Korea goes, and you know, China will do its best to keep it there purely so that it doesn't have a million refugees flooding its borders, but even when it goes, you know, what happens to those, what happens to those people, and how they can possibly reintegrate with an utterly alien society to the south?
Do you do you think then?
I pick up on 2 points here. That firstly, I'd like to respond to that. Also, you asked earlier how much of all this North Koreans actually believe. If I can,
that's exactly what I was about to ask you.
Okay, yeah. Fine. Yeah. Let's take the second point first. What's going to happen to North Koreans when the end comes? And I'm sure that, you know, the end will be sudden and probably quite messy. Firstly, the assuming that China doesn't simply annex North Korea, which I think China would be deeply reluctant to do for all kinds of reasons, and that some kind of unification happens with the South, North Koreans will find themselves not just enormously poorer than South Koreans, a gulf far greater than that between East and West Germany, but they will also find themselves trying to compete for jobs in effectively an extended South Korea. Now, South Korea is one of the most competitive societies on earth. I mean, yeah, this is a society where parents will get their children up at 4 a.m. to do extra homework just to get that slightly better grade and get that slightly better university place. It's a society where people will work 12, 14-hour days regularly right through weekends for long periods and consider this completely normal.
Yeah.
Just because if you don't, you know, somebody else will be after your job.
Yeah. And they're physically healthy and not malnourished.
They are physically healthy, they are not malnourished. The recent school results that came out showed that South Korean school children score almost highest, one of the highest in the world.
Yeah.
And how are North Koreans supposed to compete in this? I mean,
yes,
these are people who...
with their one internet computer.
With their one internet computer, with levels of education that are sub-African.
Yeah.
And with the levels of energy and efficiency that are absolutely appalling. It's a huge problem. And to tell you that, I certainly don't know what the answer is going to be. I can see there's all kinds of problems on the horizon there. But I don't get the sense either that the South Korean government has yet got a plan for this.
Yeah.
So big, big question mark. Your other point, how much do North Koreans actually believe of all this? My experience now is 5 years old, so I mean, I don't want to be quoted as current gospel. But the North Koreans that I knew varied enormously. Most of them believed bits of what they were told, some more, some less. But they tended to believe different bits. Most of them believe that Koreans are better than other people. It's always easy to believe that you're in a group that's a winning group.
Yeah.
I mean, and the extent to which human beings, I don't think just Koreans, can just dismiss evidence to the contrary in these situations is really quite startling. They used to believe that they were advanced, progressive, rich. Of course, they know now that's not true. The regime has cleverly shifted the propaganda to say that the reason that you're not advanced and rich is because North Korea is a victim. So you get the victimhood propaganda coming through, that the world's picked on North Korea, you're being bullied by the United States, and that North Korea is one of the few countries to stand up to American imperialism. The Chinese dwarves have, of course, all capitulated, as you'd expect from Untermenschen like that. The stories of things like, you know, mountains dancing at the birth of Kim Jong-il, that kind of stuff, the educated kind of outer elite of Pyongyang don't believe as such. They regard them as pretty myths.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it's a bit like the Christmas story. Of course, you know, not everybody believes every detail of these things, but in North Korean society, it's considered really rather bad taste to spoil the story by saying,
right,
you know, we don't think this.
Okay. My final question then, given that we've described a state of madness, which sounds much like a lunatic asylum, Rob Colville, why does it matter? Why does it draw the world's attention in this way? Why is this balmy state still so relevant?
Well, I mean, there are sort of more immediately dangerous places in the world. I mean, what's going on in Syria at the moment? You know, the threat of Iran, but the thing with North Korea, I think, I mean, the fascinating thing for me is the idea that it's not just a one dictator, it's a sort of broken society. But also, I think just its position. I mean, we've seen this year, the other story in the region has been the sort of the rise of tensions between China and Japan,
yeah,
China and the Philippines, China and everyone. And North Korea is a sort of key part of that. Everyone focuses on the nuclear thing, and to be honest, that's never been quite as significant, because North Korea still possesses enough conventional artillery to flatten Seoul. I mean, the distances involved are so tiny that, you know, that if something triggers North Korea, then there will be carnage on an unimagined scale and a humanitarian disaster on an unimaginable scale. And everything we've spoken about today shows that North Korea is the one country that is most likely to go and do something completely crazy.
Right, to disintegrate.
Because it's rational by its own lights, but it sure as hell isn't rational by ours.
Right. So really, we misfocus our attention when we talk about the nuclear thing. We should really be talking about a broader societal problem than just a problem
well,
located
obviously we should be terrified that these people
the
have
Kim
nuclear
family.
Weapons, but we should
yeah.
be terrified that they have weapons of any kind, really.
Right, right. Okay. John?
Yeah, firstly, this isn't a mad country. Can
right.
we make clear on that?
Okay.
This is a country whose belief system is completely alien to ours.
Right.
But with once you accept the premises of North Korean belief, then the policy follows rationally.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the Kims generally have acted has not been insane.
Right.
If anything, it's been very cool and very calculating. We are not dealing with lunatics. Why does North Korea matter? Because it's dangerous. You're right, at the moment, a lot more people are dying in Syria than are dying in Korea. But North Korea has the capacity from the present situation, where it provides something between interest and sort of mild comic relief to Western commentators, to absolute catastrophe
mm-hmm.
very quickly. You rightly point to the weapons pointed at Seoul. North Korea could actually flatten a major industrial city, which is not going to happen in Syria or Afghanistan, because you know, there aren't any there, effectively. The possession of nuclear weapons, proven nuclear weapons, we've now had three tests. We know that they can actually detonate a plutonium bomb. Although their delivery systems are primitive, if they wanted to simply put one of these things on the back of a boat or the back of a lorry and deliver it to somewhere, unlike the blue touch paper, you know, we would be looking at the obliteration of a city.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Koreans have a proven record of using violence in pursuit of their political objectives. Remember that in 2010, they sank a South Korean corvette, they shelled a South Korean island, they're prepared to kill.
Yeah.
And I think we would be deluding ourselves to imagine that they're not prepared to take violence just a bit further. Another point is the alliance system. China is a formal ally of North Korea. And China is worried that if North Korea collapses, not only will it face floods of refugees, as you rightly said, across the border, but also that the United States will move its troops north of the 38th parallel, perhaps even up to China's borders. I mean, I don't think the United States has any intention of doing this, but the Chinese worry about these things. With the result that in continued instability in North Korea, there is a risk of miscalculation, not just by the North Koreans, but by regional powers that might lead to a direct confrontation between major powers with slightly worrying consequences. The South Koreans, I think if China did send troops across the joint border, and of course we've got Chinese exercises going on the border right now, they would react very quickly. You'd have South Korean troops moving north to prevent too much of North Korea falling into Chinese hands. What happens when those two forces meet? And what happens then to the United States forces in Korea?
On that note, we wish our listeners a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year in the hope that there still will be one. John Everard and Rob Colbill, thank you both very much. Thank you for listening to The Telegram. We'll be back in January. We hope you have a very nice Christmas, and we hope you'll join us in the new year.